was run out of town, tarred and feathered with a noose around his neck. The sponsor of the new Dodge City 3-day background check. He could have ridden with Billy the Kid and robbed the Fargo stage, but he noticed William was carrying a firearm. Underage Brady Bill, gunfighter without a gun. He's the fastest pistol in the West if he would only purchase one. He's got the rope and the saddle and the horse and the girls and the real big fancy hat. But it's hard to be a gunfighter and a liberal Democrat. Brady Bill, gunfighter without a gun. Most hated man in Deadwood, they say he killed Hickok, 'cause in the hands of every dead man is a childproof safety lock. And who knows, but the legend goes he'd still be alive today. But he turned in his Colt Peacemaker in a concert ticket giveaway. Brady Bill, gunfighter without a gun. He's the fastest pistol in the West if he would only purchase one. He's got the rope and the saddle and the horse and the girls and impressive shooting stats. But it's hell being a gunfighter and a liberal Democrat. Brady Bill, gunfighter without a gun. On a gun roundup in Tombstone, met a duck named Holiday, who was pulling teeth and leading a lynch mob from the NRA.
Kill him! Kill him!
Bill said if you'd vote for Medicare, we'd cure that nasty cough. Now Bill's lying 6 feet under, but at least he's cooling off. Brady Bill, gunfighter without a gun. He's the fastest pistol in the West if he would only purchase one.
He's a coward!
He's really down on firearms and down these pesky nets. There's enough out here to bug a man without having to deal with that. Brady Bill, gunfighter without a gun.
Bill, when you get those nets out of your face, I want you to draw.
Cookie, I can't draw because you didn't give enough money to the National Endowment for the Arts.
You're against the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, Bill.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Chester. I've always looked at the Constitution as being a living, breathing document that can change when society has finally decided that...
There's your living, breathing document. Any dying words, Brady Bill?
Just one thing, Chester. Save a bullet for that background singer.
Here he is, Tim Wilson, one of the funniest guys. And now a lot of people don't know about Tim Wilson, but you look him up. He's got a hell of a lot of funny songs, and that was the one about gun control. How about that? This is Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker, and it's October the 21st, 2014, and it's Terrors Day. The temperature inside in the bunker is 39 degrees. Whoops, just jumped up to 45, 40. Wait a minute, that thing's jumping all... Hey, the Frank Silva Memorial clock is acting a little funny. Oh, I know why. I got that big-ass lamp right above it. So we don't know what to do. Okay. Yeah, it's overcast. We've had quite a few overcast days here in a row. But it's not raining. It's a little cool. It's down in the... This morning it was the high 40s. So we're getting there. We're inching towards the winter time. Yeah, that reminds me. Brady bit the dust here, what, a few months ago? Yeah. And, well, if he hadn't run around with such shitty people like Ronald Reagan, he'd have been all right. But he was Ronald Reagan's, what, press secretary or what? And he didn't get down quick enough, and he took a blast of 22s and sort of messed him up. But he's gone now to his just reward. Hope all you people got the wake-up call this morning with our new little wake-up session that I'm sending out MP3s in the morning, most mornings. Probably won't be every morning, but we talked about how to make a lot of money, get into the manufacturing business of manufacturing bombs. You can get filthy rich real fast. You know, a couple of times I've said that those rockets are sending out of those fighter planes over there in the Middle East were probably around $50,000 apiece or something. Well, hell, I found out that they're $1.5 million apiece, and they've shot 40 of them off in less than a month. How do you like that, taxpayer? And that's these Republicans are all for that kind of stuff. I'm gonna pick on the Democrats too, but not as much as the Republicans. Yeah, go get them, man. 40 million an hour. How about that? Or no, it'd be more than 40 million an hour. And then they cry about, well, there's too much taxes. Yeah, we got too much government. Well, it takes a lot of government to put out that kind of firepower. It's amazing, especially the Republican War Party, how they want to build roads, they want to build up the infrastructure, not only the United States, but other countries, but yet they're blowing money so fast you can't believe it. It's insane. It is absolutely insane, man. Well, let's go back to Exiles from History, a great booklet put out by David McCollum, who's deceased now, but boy, he left his mark with this. And we've read some of it to you. Now we're going to go back and read some more. Karl Marx's true family name was, of course, Levy. And his family's adoption of token Christianity was purely for business rather than theological reasons. Many of Marx's contributions to the Tribune were anti-Semitic in nature. Just by way of example, his feature published on 4 January 1856 read as follows. Quote, take Amsterdam, for instance, a city harboring many of the worst descendants of the Jews whom Ferdinand and Isabella drove out of Spain and who, after lingering a while in Portugal, were driven out of there too and eventually found a place in a retreat in Holland. Here and there and everywhere that a little capital courts investment. There is ever one of these little Jews ready to make a little suggestion or a place, a little bit of loan. The smartest highwayman in the Abruzzi is not better posted about the locale of the hard cash in a traveler's valise or pocket than these little Jews about any loose capital in the hands of a trader. Thus, we find every tyrant backed by a Jew, as is every pope by a Jesuit. In truth, the cravings of oppression would be hopeless and the practicability of war out of the question if there were not an army of Jesuits to smother thought and a handful of Jews to ransack the pockets. The fact that 1,855 years ago the alleged Christ drove the Jewish money changers out of the temple, and that the money changers of our age enlisted on the side of tyranny again happened to be Jews is perhaps no more than historic coincidence. You know, even Marx didn't understand that there was no Jesus, and no Jesus drove the money changers out of the temple. The average person thinks that temple was a little teeny thing, but the temple was about 30 acres. It was a big damn place filled with hundreds of traders and pawn brokers and cattle. Everything was in there. You realize what it'd take? It would have taken Superman to clear that temple out. Anyhow, it's just a sidelight. So anyone that says that Karl Marx was not anti-Semitic, well, anti-Jew, or anti-himself, think again. I haven't read anything any harder on the Jews than what I just quoted to you. Marx himself was extremely sensitive about his own Jewish origins. He married a Gentile woman, Jenny von Westphalen, a beautiful aristocratic Prussian who had fallen under Marx's spell in their hometown of Trier. Gee, I'd been in Trier several times when I was stationed in Germany. I wonder if I walked on the same sidewalks he did. Marx himself was typically Jewish in appearance, according to Carl Peter Heinzen, who worked with Marx in the 1840s. Marx had, quote, wildly disheveled coal black hair, and his complexion was dirty yellow. Whether the dirty complexion was in nature made it, or whether the dirt came from outside, can no more be decided than whether his shirt and his clothes were originally made in a dirty color or merely acquired dirt. I guess when he used to hang out at the library in London, people used to stay away from him. He smelled so bad. That's what I heard. But who knows? That could be a neocon false flag. Robert Payne, The Unknown Karl Marx, page 154 to 155. On one occasion, when Marx's son-in-law, Charles Laquette, wrote a flattering article about Marx in a Paris newspaper, he inadvertently outraged his subject by referring to his Jewish origins. Marx flew into a rage and demanded that the unfortunate Laquette never mention his name again in his writings. Marx's second daughter, Laura, married Paul Lafarbe in 1845. Marx had done everything possible to prevent the marriage, totally on account of Lafarbe's small portion of Negro blood. But when Lafarbe's wealthy parents promised a groom's dowry of 100,000 francs, Marx's attitude reversed. However, when the gift did not materialize, Marx reverted to racist slurs against his daughter's husband. Marx remarked that one of the daughters was doing her bit in solving the color question by marrying a nigger. He often referred to Lafargue as the little Negro or as the gorilla when Laura bore a second child in 1870. Jenny Marx wrote Ingalls that she hoped her daughter would practice reproductive restraint and not produce 10 little nigger boys. When Lafargue decided to run in the municipal Paris elections, Ingalls, too, remarked that this was appropriate since the district contained the Paris Zoo, and a nigger is a degree nearer to the animal kingdom than the rest of us. In fact, Karl Marx was as racist as any Ku Klux Klansman. He believed that slavery was essential to the American progress. He supported the idea of a greater German empire extending over the Lumpengeisendom, meaning rabble, to the east. Many examples of this attitude are quoted in Nathaniel Wiles' stunning book, Karl Marx, Racist, Arlington House, 1979. I'm going to have to get that book. Wiles reveals that little of Marx's economic theorizing was his own. Even his most famous slogan in the Communist Manifesto, Workers of the World Unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to gain, unquote, was lifted verbatim from a German revolutionary, Karl Schäfer. The Marxian idea that society can be divided into two classes was as old as the hills. It had been propounded by Helvetius, by Marat, by Babeuf, and many others. the term class struggle, had been in use in Britain as early as 1844 in the agitational writings of the Chartist leader Fergus O'Connor. The idea that the working man has no country was put forward long before Marx. Wait a minute here. Long before Marx. Oh, by the English novelist Edward Bulwer Lytton. That's interesting. My birth name was Linton. This is spelled Lytton. In 1833, his notion of this, of thesis plus antithesis, bringing about synthesis, was originally put forward by Hegel, of which Slingblade talks about all the time, and I tend to agree with that too. In 1867, the first volume of Das Kapital was published in German. Marx had offered it to dedicate it to Charles Darwin, but was politely declined. Marx had earlier described Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species, as being developed in the coarse English manner. The first volume did not appear in English until 1887, translated by Samuel Moore and Edward Aveling, the latter being the common-law husband of Marx's youngest daughter, Eleanor. The second volume of the work was issued by Ingalls in 1885, after the death of Marx. The third volume appeared in 1894, and the final portion did not see the light of day until 1905 to 1910, under the editorship of Karl Kautsky. The Russian anarchist Michael Bakunin was originally taken in by Marx's rhetoric. I've read all of Bakunin's work, and I have a lot of respect for Bakunin's work. And you should read it sometime. In 1868, he began to translate Das Kapital into Russian, but he abandoned the project when he began to realize the true nature of Marx's theory and the man behind it. He wrote, quote, "We met fairly often because I very much admired him for his knowledge and for his passionate and earnest devotion to the cause of the proletariat, although it always had in an admixture of personal vanity, and I eagerly sought his conversation, which was witty so long as it was not inspired by petty spite, which unfortunately happened very often, but there was never any real intimacy between us. Our temperaments did not allow it. He called me a sentimental idealist, and he was right. I called him morose, vain, and treacherous. And I, too, was right." E. H. Carl, Bakunin, page 129. The friendship did not last long. When Bakunin began to emerge as an ideological rival to Marx, the latter resorted to every dirty trick in the book to discredit him. In 1848, he published some tittle-tattle in the New Rheinische Zeitung that it was rumored that Bakunin was a czarist spy. Sounds familiar? Like the right wing? If you don't like somebody, they're always a spy. They're paid in forbit. Or they're a humu. This totally mendacious smear was afterwards withdrawn. Later, when the two actually did contend for the leadership of the First Internationale. That's interesting, because I think the First Internationale was held in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm going to have to recheck that. Marx referred to Bakunin's Russian cunning and described all his followers as Cossacks, according to Nathaniel Weil. Quote, "Marx won the battle for control of the Internationale primarily because he had rich friends who paid the travel expenses of the delegates he needed to give him a majority. Bakunin lacked such connections." So maybe it wasn't Indianapolis, because it must have cost a lot of money to get all these guys over to Indianapolis. Bakunin was quick to realize that there was more to this Marxism than met the eye. In Max Nomad's Apostles of Revolution, he was quoted as saying, quote, "The minority, the Marxists say, will consist of workers. Yes, perhaps of former workers. And these, as soon as they become rulers, or representatives of the people, will cease to be workers and will look upon the entire world of manual workers from the heights of the state. They will no longer represent the people, but themselves and their own pretensions to rule the people. Whoever has any doubt about that does not know human nature. That's an interesting statement from Karl Marx. Later, Bakunin would become even more embittered and even more insightful. Quote, Marx is a Jew and is surrounded by a crowd of little more or less intelligent, scheming, agile, speculating Jews, just as Jews are everywhere. Commercial and banking agents, writers, politicians, correspondents for the newspapers of all shades, in short, literary brokers, just as they are financial brokers, with one foot in the bank and the other in the socialist movement, and their asses sitting upon the German press. They have grabbed hold of all newspapers, and you can imagine what a nauseating literature is the outcome of it. Now this entire Jewish world, which constitutes an exploiting sect, a people of leeches, a voracious parasite, closely and intimately connected with another, regardless not only of the frontiers but of political differences as well. This Jewish world is today largely at the disposal of Marx or Rothschild. I'm sure of that. On the one hand, the Rothschilds appreciate the merits of Marx, and that on the other hand, Marx feels an instinctive inclination and a great respect for the Rothschilds. This may seem strange. What could there be in common between communism and high finance? Ho, ho! The communism of Marx seeks a strong state centralization. And where this exists, there the parasite Jewish nation, which speculates upon the labor of the people, will always find the means for its existence. Quote, in reality, this would be for the proletariat a barrack regime, under which the working men and the working women, converted into a uniform mass, would rise, fall asleep, work, live at the beat of the drum. The privilege of ruling would be in the hands of the skilled and the learned, with a wide scope left for profitable, crooked deals carried out by the Jews, who would be attracted by the enormous extension of the international speculations of the national banks. Boy, if that doesn't fit now. And you see what they did in Russia under this same system. People, the working class, mainly poor, shuffling along in a very colorless society. Michael Bakunin, he said in 1872, Bakunin must have had a crystal ball, for his native homeland became the first to fall victim to this enormous and cruel confidence trick. Incited by the Jewish Bolsheviks, the Russian people rose up against the ruling class, only to find that the czars would be replaced by the Bolsheviks, and the country turned into a financial strip mine for Western Jewish capitalists, from the Olaf Ashberg and Jacob Schiff, who financed the Bolshevik takeover, to Armin Hammer, who makes vast profits from exclusive trade deals with the supposedly anti-Semitic commissars today. Unlike Marx, who had studiously avoided physical involvement in the revolution on the streets, Bakunin and manned the barricades in the 1848 rebellion in Dresden, in the 1870 rebellion in Lyon. For his troubles in Dresden, he was to spend many years in the Peter and Paul prison in St. Petersburg, from which he emerged prematurely aged and toothless. In 1873, Bakunin wrote of Marx in State and Anarchy, quote, in origin, Herr Marx is a Hebrew. He unites himself, one may say, all the characteristics and the shortcomings of this gifted tribe. Nervous, as they say, to the point of cowardice, he is extraordinarily ambitious and vain, quarrelsome, intolerant, and absolutist, like Jehovah, the Lord God of his ancestors, who is like Marx himself, vengeful to the point of madness. There is no lie or calumny that he is not capable of inventing against anyone who has had misfortune of arousing his jealousy, or, which is the same thing, his hatred. Bakunin was not the only one to attribute Marx's character to his ancestry. While the editor of the Zeitung newspaper, Marx had chosen as his Vienna correspondent a notorious Germanophile and anti-Semite, Edward von Mueller Tellering. After the relationship soured, question here, did the Tellering discover his editor's ethnic origins? The Austrian authored the very first pamphlet to attack Marx. He called Marx cowardly, garlic-smelling, arrogantly Jesuitical, a chief rabbi. For the first time in his life, Marx was speechless for a response. An insight into Marx's psychology may be garnered by examining his attitudes towards bodily functions. According to Weil, his favorite expression in his correspondence was with Engels is shit. In his attack on the Jewish editor of the Daily Telegraph, Marx wrote that just as all the laboratories of London spewed their physical filth into the Thames, so did all the social filth pour into the central sewer called the Daily Telegraph. He suggested that as Levy was the presiding alchemist of this sewer system, he should have a plaque on his office building inscribed, "Wayfarer, stop and piss." In attacks on everyone, Marx would call them that shit. Even when he was tired of writing his own books, he would describe his work as this shit. When an infant daughter died, Marx wrote Engels that this time the whole shit has affected me deeply. After his death, Marx's youngest daughter made a diligent effort to piece together scraps of information about her late father's childhood in Trier. Although she idolized her father and made up the most beautiful legends, there is a ring of truth to his vignette of his childhood. Quote, "I have heard my aunts say that as a little boy I was a terrible tyrant to his sisters, whom he would drive down the Markusberg in Trier at full speed. And worse, he would insist on their eating the cakes he made with dirty dough and dirtier hands. But they stood the driving and the cakes without a murmur for the sake of the stories Carl would tell them as a reward for their virtue." Two familiar Marxian characteristics emerge from this story. First, Marx's passionate need to dominate others, and second, his almost obsessional preoccupation with dirt and excrement, or as he would put it in his correspondence to Engels, shit. He's a naughty boy, that Carl. Marx also exhibited many of the personality characteristics described by Erich Fromm in his Anatomy of Human Destructiveness in 1973. As a necrophilus, although Fromm focused on the German National Socialist leaders Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler, he might well have found a better candidate for his particular dysfunction in Karl Marx. In Marx's early feeble attempts at poetry, "This world is one devoid of joy, happiness, or sunshine. When nature appears to Marx, it is hostile and destructive force, grim, menacing, implacable." The following lines are typical of his approach. "Marble, pillar, towers high, jagged summits, saw the air, putrefaction, life's decay, molders in the abscess, down there, grim the cliff that upwards climbs, clamps the ground with iron limbs." Written by Karl Marx. You see, here again, a capitalist struggles against nature, and here's Karl Marx saying the same thing. These people that are power hungry seem like they always do that. Either that or they just pretend they're for nature while they serve another master. Further lines from the same collection include, "Waves are murderers, every one. They gnaw his ancient skeleton." The mannequin plucks out his eyes, digs himself a hole deep down, digs his own grave, and lies buried, buried underground. Inspired by his own self-praise, Marx then sets out to write, but never finished, a tragedy play called Olenum, the character's most projection of Marx's own personality, seethe with hatred against the world and vow for its destruction. Several characters appear to be also synonymous with the devil. Perhaps Marx sometimes thought of himself as Satan. He would often sign his letters Old Nick, the Victorian form of slang for Satan, and would tell his children endless ghost stories which bordered to the horrific. Marx's legitimate children, 3 out of 6, survived infancy, soon exhibited the same neurotic symptoms of their father. Marx doted on the 3 girls and they on him. Maintaining a cool distance from their mother, in many ways their relationship was potentially incestuous, but in any case it was certainly Cronist. Cronism, named after the Greek god Cronus, is used to describe those animals which devour their own young, although certain historical tribes, particularly the biblical Hebrews, see Judges in the Holy Bible, and the Carthaginians sacrificed their firstborn. In this case, we mean that the children were psychologically devoured by their parent. Marx's favorite among the girls was Jenny, the eldest, who was born in Paris in 1844. She was the image of her father, and she emulated his career almost to every detail. As a schoolgirl, she attempted to write poetry in 5 languages. She was prone to fantasies. She helped her father with his political agitation, but soon she would suffer from a long series of psychosomatic ailments, including asthma, chronic cough, and insomnia. Her marriage to the socialist Charles Loquet was a disaster, lurching from one crisis to the next. However, they were still managed to produce 6 children. Loquet deliberately tried to act as a father substitute to Jenny, but when this failed, he was overcome with guilt. Eventually, Jenny died at the age of 39 after suffering cancer of the bladder. The Marx's second daughter, Laura, was born in Brussels in 1845, also committed to her father's ideals. Laura helped out the translating both her father's and Engels' writings into various languages. She fell in love with the French Creole Paul Lafargue, and despite her parents' racist epithets, married him. All of their 3 children died in infancy. Lafargue drifted from his medical profession into socialist politics, but one day in November 1911 they committed suicide together and were found stone dead, sitting side by side in their Paris home. I think that happens with a lot of people that are anti-nature and don't see the wonderful things about nature. They get, when their man-made plans don't go right for them, they become depressed and suicidal. The youngest daughter, Eleanor, was born in 1855, whereas her sister, Laura, was somewhat cool and aloof. Eleanor was highly charged emotionally. She was dark and Semitic in appearance, and initially was something of a tomboy. From an early age, she wanted to go on stage. Then in 1872, at the age of 17, she fell in love with a 34-year-old Frenchman. Her father forbade the relationship, and she eventually acceded to his wishes, but the price was a lifetime of neurotic psychosomatic ailments. When Marx finally died and she no longer had to be in his little princess, she took her revenge by taking up with Edward Aveling, an evil rogue who was condemned by everyone within and without Marx's circles. Aveling, who was already married to another woman, lived and traveled with Eleanor for 14 years. Eventually, he married a young actress, and in desperation, Eleanor swallowed cyanide. Boy, these people are... what a bunch of people. Oh, God, it's depressing. there is some evidence that Aveling had promised her a suicide pact and betrayed her. Marks also sired an illegitimate son, Freddy, by the household servant. He was screwing his maid. Lunch at DeMuth. But in order not to upset his wife, he prevailed upon Ingalls to acknowledge paternity over the boy. No one was taken in by this feeble ruse, but at least it enabled Marks to renege on any financial responsibilities for raising the boy and pass these over to the gullible Ingalls. Eleanor grew very close to Freddie DeMuth and experienced great difficulty in reconciling her adulation of her father with his treatment of the boy, leaving him to sink or swim in the London slums. 2 months before her suicide, she wrote, "Freddie, I sometimes feel like you, Freddie, that nothing ever goes well with us." Of course, poor Jenny had her full share of sorrow and trouble, and Laura lost her children. But Jenny was fortunate enough to die. And sad as that was for the children, there are times when I think it was fortunate. I would not have wished Jenny to have lived through what I have done. Unquote. In choosing a relationship with the sadistic exploiter Aveling, was Eleanor reenacting the masochistic role that her father had thrust upon her when he insisted on her rejection of her French suitor and instead taking care of the number one man in his life? Daddy, were the suicides of both Laura and Eleanor and the psychosomatic death of Jenny belated and indirect acts of rebellion and aggression against their tyrannical father? Psychohistorian Arnold Kultzley argues, quote, "It is a frequent experience of depth psychology that the unconscious conflicts in the psyche of parents break out in the children. The suicide of daughters can be interpreted as delayed surrogate suicide of Marx himself. I will take proud revenge on myself," he had written as a young man. Thus, in the tragic destiny of the daughters of Karl Marx, the existential alienation of the father was repeated in shattering fashion. Karl Künzler says that Karl Marx, Eline Psychography, Vienna, 1966. Perhaps the most profound summary of all was provided by Karl Marx himself in a short time before his death of bronchitis at the age of 64 in 1883. In a rare moment of candor, he had told his octoroon son-in-law, Paul Lafarge, "One thing I am certain of, that is, that I myself am not a Marxist." Wait a minute. Karl Marx, perhaps the most profound summary of all, was provided by Karl Marx himself a short time before his death of bronchitis at the age of 64 in 1883. In a rare moment of candor, he had told his octoroon son-in-law, Paul Lafargue, "One thing I am certain of, that is that I myself am not a Marxist." Jesus. He started all this stuff and then later it becomes Bolshevism in Russia and millions of people die and he's convinced he's not really a Marxist after all. What better summary could there be of a man who was tormented throughout his life by hypocrisy? On the one hand, he despised the workers, Slavs, Negroes, and proletarians generally. Yet at the same time, he wrote about the eventual takeover by the working class. He loathed the Jews and Jewish characteristics, yet he knew deep down that he himself was a Jew through and through, and that could never change. He was pursued by the hereditary Jewish fixations on excrement, death, putrefaction, and dirt. See, all this is really anti-nature, just like the Christians. And yet he sought to conquer these primeval fears through the overcompensating pushiness, arrogance, manipulation, demanding, and even megalomania. He sought refuge with his WASP aristocratic wife, Jenny von Westphalen, and with the Germanic Frederick Ingalls. But nowhere could he escape the eternal truth of his origins. He was rebelling against himself. He was caught up in an eternal Jewish struggle, the underlying self-hate and the overlay of compensatory arrogance and assimilation. The eternal struggle became too much for his daughters, who tried to wriggle free of his vice-like grip of their own psyches. Each one of them rebelled against the eternal truth of their own Jewish genetics and took up with Gentiles, curiously all Frenchmen. But each in turn was dragged down by their father into the cauldron of torment that is being Jewish. Like a drowning man clutching at the riverbank, they tried to save themselves from being swept away, but swept away they were, in Laura's case taking her rescuer with her. The other two sisters went on a course marked self-destruct, and whether the course was labeled groin cancer or falling in love with a sadist and then committing suicide makes no difference. Each was but a terminal symptom of the disease we must surely recognize as Jewish self-hate. Well, I hope you got that and digested, because that's one of the best observations of Karl Marx that I've ever seen, boiled down to a few pages. And let's see, we're not going to go do any more reading today because you probably all went to sleep anyhow. Well, next we're going to go on to Leon Trotsky and see what old Leon the Jew was up to. A lot of you probably know most of what he was up to, but I think McCollum really gets into the nitty-gritty. Well, we got this stupid election coming up. Oh, Christ. And to listen to him babble on TV like a bunch of chimpanzees and orangutans. It's something else. Dark money hits 100 million with help from single candidate groups. Let's see what this is all about. Spending by groups that don't discuss their donors in 2014 midterm elections has crested at 100 million already, a figure that is well ahead of what was spent on congressional races at this point in any other cycle, and that most is yet to come. Of course, you know where most of this money goes. It goes to the corporate media and all these agents that they use to try to get elected. How much more? Probably at least another 100 million if past experience is a guide. In the last seven cycles going back to 2000, more than 54% of the eventual total dark money spent on average occurred in the final weeks before the election. In only one cycle, 2008, had more than half it been spent by October 8. In all other cycles, anywhere from 50 to 72% of dark money outlays came after that date. All figures are based on spending that the groups reported to the FEC. And despite the slowdown of 2014 spending relative to the 2012 cycle, the current cycle outpaces all previous ones when spending on the presidential contest is factored out. By this point in 2012, only $73 million had been spent in congressional races by groups that don't disclose their donors. Mostly 501c4 social welfare organizations and 501c6 trade associations under the tax code. In 2010, that total was just under $65 million, so they're really blowing it out now. It's going to run about $200 million for this election coming up. And this dark money landmark year, for another reason, the birth of the single candidate 501c organization. Last summer, 501c4, called Oklahomans for the Conservative Future, dropped nearly 1.3 million in the state's Republican primary in an effort to support T.W. Shannon's failed bid against Representative James Lankford, Republican Oklahoma, to replace retiring GOP Senator Tom Coburn. The group, founded only months before the primary, has gone dormant since Shannon's defeat. Now, you see, the loser spent $1.3 million. in a state case race. In Kentucky, which is hosting one of the most contentious Senate races in the country, more than one-fourth of the $24.8 million in reported outside spending in the race has been spent by Kentucky Opportunity Coalition. And I submit to you that that's Kentucky coal miners, the big coal miners, most of it. Also a 501c4 organization. All of KOC's nearly $7 million in reported spending has gone towards ads attacking Democrat candidate Allison Grimes, who is seeking to oust Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, which she won't do because she is not able to attack the coal mining interests head on. You can't do that in Kentucky and ever win anything, as they continue to pollute and destroy the state through their different ways of their mining. So that son of a bitch, Mitch McConnell, will get back in. And he never saw a war he didn't like, and he never saw the destruction of the ecology that he didn't like. KOC was founded in 2008, according to Kentucky state records, and the IRS granted the group exempt status in February 2009. Don't you wish you could get... None of the groups that we've ever had in this country, racial groups, has ever been able to get tax exemption. I know that Ben Klassen told me he was going to go for tax exemption. That's why he's calling it a church. I said, Ben, you're out of your mind. You'll never get it. Oh, yeah, Ben says. He'll get it. Well, he didn't get it. National Alliance didn't get it either. I knew they wouldn't. Their group has never filed a Form 990, an annual submission that lays out some of the 501c organization activities with the IRS because it claims never to have raised more than $50,000, thus falling into a category that is exempt from filing requirement. Well, that's bullshit. Somebody's lying through their teeth. IRS summary data from 2012, the last year of which data is available, says the KOC neither raised nor spent any money that year. Now it is outspending every other outside spending group. 501c, super PAC, or party committees active in Kentucky raises by more than $2.5 million, which is primarily coming from energy companies, coal miners, not the working class people who mine coal. We're talking about the big boys at the top. At this point in 2012, the dark money groups that would go on to be the top 10 spenders had spent on average about 38% of the funds they would ultimately end up reporting to the FEC. And most signs indicate that these groups stand ready to make generous outlays for their final appeals to the voters. Boy, I'll tell you, they're going to... And these figures don't include millions more spent by the groups on issue ads that don't explicitly call for voters to elect or defeat a candidate. Such ads don't have to be reported to the FEC unless they occur 30 days before the primary or 60 days before the general election. Crossroads GPS, for instance, is said to have raised about $75 million this year, a sizable portion of which it has already spent on issue ads like this, and more of which plans to spend in coming weeks. It's already making good on the promise in Kentucky and Louisiana. You see, the bulk of the people don't support anything. They give their tens and twenties, maybe a couple of $100. This is all big money, all big capitalist money that controls the game. After a conservative 501c4 group, Americans for Prosperity. Oh, this is the Koch brothers. That's the one that rolled into town here in a big, about a 40-foot long bus, all equipped, and they were there to support the Tea Party. The Koch brothers, super billionaires, are friend of the little guy at the Tea Party. What fools! Let's see here. But very little of it has been reported to the FEC. for months, the group, which said it plans to spend $125 million in 2014, has been running issue ads attacking Democratic Senate candidates in states like North Carolina, Louisiana, and Arkansas. Last week, it announced that it plans to begin calling directly for the election or defeat of such candidates, making expenses that will have to be reported. Unsurprisingly, those targeted by the group in recent weeks, Senator Mary Landrieu and Mark Pryor of Arkansas, Landrieu of Louisiana, were the subject of AFP issue ads last spring and summer. You try to tell me that money don't decide who the leaders are in this great democracy? Horse shit. Though the spending reported to the FEC by groups that don't disclose their donors is still dominant by conservative organizations. Liberal dark money groups are also spending more than in previous cycles. And you thought all that money was going to be spent to get rid of abortion or support something like that. With $19.4 million in total spending, liberal dark money groups have just edged out the $18.6 million they had spent at this point in 2012. Well, they're over the top. But that total includes some presidential spending. Compared to the last midterms, however, the difference is much more noticeable. As of October 8, 2010, liberal dark money groups had spent just $2.7 million. Oh, man. Well, that's enough of that for today. If you're not sick of the stomach by now, maybe I could find something else here. We've got a few minutes left in the show. Now, to keep up on all these politicians and these groups and where the money's coming from, go to opensecrets.org and keep an eye on that, because they're pretty damn good about showing up these guys. We had this political meeting down at the amphitheater here in town a couple of weeks ago. I was expecting my congressman to show up. The guy had a write-in candidate against him. I had questions I wanted to ask him, but wouldn't have been any good because they weren't taking any questions from the audience. I wanted to ask him, hey, Mr. Sir, how do you feel about welfare? And I know what he would said. Oh, welfare is bad. We got to watch that stuff because there's people laying on their ass and collecting all this money. And then I was going to come back with, then, why are you on welfare? What do you mean I'm on welfare? Well, you're getting $1 million a year not to grow crops. $1 million a year on your big agricultural plantation not to grow crops. Now, that is the most biggest welfare con that I've ever seen. It reminds me of Stennis. He's dead now down in Mississippi, who ran a regular plantation, even up until the 70s, I think. He ran that area with an iron fist, an iron hand. And Stennis was collecting millions for not growing things on his land. Yeah. I remember, and I may have mentioned this one time, when I got out of the Army and was thinking of staying around here, Warsaw, Indiana, I could have bought a 40-acre farm, and I was tempted to do that. And they said, oh, it's no problem. You just farm half of it, plant whatever you want, and the other half, just let it go fallow, don't raise anything on it, and the money you'll get from the government for that 20 acres, you can pay for the farm. Such a deal. I mean, magnify that by thousands and thousands of people out there who do that kind of stuff. And the same Republican people that are involved in that kind of stuff are yelling and screaming, we don't want no socialism. You can't take my Medicare, but we can't have socialism. We can't have farm subsidies. We can't have all this shit. You're a bunch of socialists. It's funny as hell, man. It's sad, too. Just remember, if voting would change things, they'd make it illegal.
Banks is what's wrong with this whole damn country.
And it ain't the tellers.
I'm just doing my job, sir. I'm just doing my job.
Well, you're sucking at it, lady. I'll say that. I bounced a $3 check. Charge me $30 for a $3 check. Now, if I ain't got three, I damn sure ain't got 33. It don't take an accountant to figure this up, you know. And they'll send you that statement in the mail. Try to make you look bad in front of your kids. You're raising kids, you ain't got $3. They call it service charge. But paying the tellers $5 an hour. I'm sure it took her 6 hours to work on my little $3 check.
I'm just about to get off work. This $3 check showed up. I'll be here till midnight.
I got a bank in Atlanta, Georgia. Charges you $3 to check the balance in your savings account. In other words, you walk in. How much money have I got in this account?
$300. Well, $297.
How much? $294. So theoretically, if I ask you another 98 times how much money I got, I ain't got no more damn money. Banks don't even give out lollipops at the drive-thru anymore. Can't get a lollipop at a bank drive-thru. Hell, I grew up on bank candy. I don't know about y'all, I put $100 in the bank, damn it. I want a bag of Tootsie Roll. Much money as we give these people, we ought to have Whitman samplers waiting on our... Nothing on that cream stuff either. I want macadamia nuts in my drink.
Well, that's it, boys and girls, for today. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And we hope we get some sunshine. We want to see the All-Father here, man. I'm getting lonely. 14-5, and don't let them in. Don't go with them unless they got a warrant. And just say, I have nothing to say. And you see this mouth? That's my pie hole. And my pie hole's going to stay shut.